Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Sunday, August 17, 2014, and I'm your host, Carolyn Baker. Tonight I'm speaking to you not from my usual location in Boulder, Colorado, but from the very hot desert sands of New Mexico. No, I'm not visiting Guy McPherson. I'm catching a little R&R in a region of the Southwest where I used to live and visiting with old friends and allies in the Land of Enchantment. We have no guests tonight, so it's just you and me, and a little later in the show, I definitely want to hear from you. Speaking of the Southwest, next week on the show, we're going to have Laura Carlson with us, who is a longtime activist, author, and researcher on Latin American and U.S.-Mexican border issues. She works with the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy, and she's going to give us the historical and geopolitical background of the current child migrant crisis on the U.S. southern border. Regardless of where you live in the U.S., this is a crisis that affects you on some level. Do not miss what Laura Carlson, L-A-U-R-A, Carlson has to say next week on the Lifeboat Hour about this crisis and what we can do to address it. This week, some of you may have seen an article posted on Truthdig and also on Facebook entitled Climate Change Heralds the End of Civilizations by Paul Brown, who has been a longtime environmental correspondent for The Guardian. In it, Brown writes, quote, scientists looking at what is known as the Fertile Crescent of ancient Mesopotamia have found new evidence that drought caused by climate change brings an end to civilizations. It is the latest study that confirms the threat posed to present civilizations in Africa, Asia, and parts of the United States by changes in rainfall patterns that could lead to the abandonment of once fertile areas and the cities that once were fed by them, unquote. But when we look at ancient history, we see that the Mayan people in what is now Central America were threatened by a 200-year drought. Of this, Brown writes, this was a people that had the time, money, and manpower to build massive temples and cities for a population estimated at 13 million. Many theories have been put forward as to why, over a period of about 200 years, from 750 to 950 AD, the Mayans abandoned their way of life. Research on the subject by Sigma Chi, the scientific research society based in the U.S., says that a series of droughts caused by local climate change was the cause. Now, I want to return to the subject of the Mayan people a little later in the show, but for right now, I want to note a shift in my thinking and probably in the thinking of a lot of our listeners regarding the collapse of industrial civilization. Whereas many of us for a number of years were focused on peak oil and energy depletion as the ultimate causes of the collapse of industrial civilization, it seems that that scenario, as inevitable as it is, has been eclipsed by climate change in terms of the speed at which the collapse of industrial civilization is unfolding. In other words, it may well be that catastrophic climate change will exacerbate all forms of collapse, and it seems to be driving the collapse train, serving as the engine of the train, with economic collapse and peak oil following close behind. Paul Brown's article emphasizes the catastrophic effects of drought all over the world. Now, he could have written about acidic oceans, or Fukushima, or melting ice in the Arctic, or extreme weather events all over the planet, but he chose to focus on drought. And I am certainly feeling it here in the Southwest at this moment, where in this part of New Mexico, the groundwater table has fallen 25 feet in 5 years. And we should always bear in mind how closely drought is connected with food production. In drought, not only do people and animals not have enough water to drink, but drought also means a lack of water with which to grow food. Ultimately, as we see with the Mayans and other civilizations, droughts long enough and severe enough lead to extinction of species. And as you probably noticed, I haven't even mentioned the epic drought in California at all. Well, we could continue talking about drought throughout the entire show, but I want to introduce our first song, which is absolutely 180 degrees in theme and essence from that topic. I'd like to introduce this song with a poem that was given to me for my recent birthday by my friend Judith. Often when I feel closest to despair or in my deepest grief, like probably many of you do, I turn to other species for wisdom and inspiration. One species that leads the way is the dolphin. As you hear this song, or these sounds, I invite you to appreciate not only the dolphin, but the abundant waters they swim in, which are becoming increasingly scarce and polluted. And here's a poem about them by Mary Oliver to introduce the song. It's entitled 100 White-Sided Dolphins on a Summer Day. Fat, black, slick, galloping in the pitch of the waves, in the pearly fields of the sea, they leap toward us. They rise, sparkling, and vanish, and rise, sparkling. They breathe little clouds of mist. They lift perpetual smiles. They slap their tails on the waves, grandmothers and grandfathers enjoying the old jokes. They circle around us. They swim with us. 100 white-sided dolphins on a summer day, each one, as God himself could not appear more acceptable 100 times, in a body blue and black, threading through the sea foam and lifting himself up from the opened tents of the waves on his fishtail to look with the moon of his eye into my heart and find there pure, sudden, steep, sharp, painful gratitude that falls, I don't know, either unbearable tons or the pale, bearable hand of salvation on my neck, lifting me from the boat's plain plank seat into the world's unspeakable kindness. It is my 63rd summer on Earth, and for a moment, I have almost vanished into the body of the dolphin, into the moon eye of God, into the white sand that lies at the bottom of the sea with everything that ever was or ever will be, supple, wild, rising on flank or fishtail, singing or whistling or breathing damply through blowhole at top of head. Then, in our little boat, the dolphins suddenly gone, we sailed on through the brisk, cheerful day. And now, let's take a few minutes to listen, really listen, to our dolphin friends. One of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard. Thank you, dolphin brothers and sisters. May you remain with us a very long time, and please show us what we can do to help you. and may we listen. So as we've talked about many times on this show, as we navigate this time of endings, we need to stay with the question, what did I come here to do? How can I serve? And what do I have to offer? That's really the topic of tonight's show. And later, I'd like to hear from you, some of you, about what you feel or know you have to offer and how you're doing that right now. How are you expressing your unique gifts for the well-being of all living beings? Last week on this show, my guest was Andrew Harvey, and this week he sent me a fabulous book, which I can't put down, entitled Animal Wisdom, Learning from the Spiritual Lives of Animals by Linda Bender. She's a veterinarian who's lived all over the world and is now based in Southern California. You can learn more about her work at lindabender.org. I very much want to have her on the Lifeboat Hour at some point because she just has such an amazing repertoire of gifts in terms of animals and skills and background in working with them. And one sentence that leapt out at me in her book, which is so incredibly resonant with my work and what we explore on this show, is this quote, "When you're truly alive, you do not fear death. You do not fear anything." That sounds very simple, but of course it isn't. On this show, we've talked a great deal about being in a planetary and personal hospice situation at this time in our evolution. And I believe that if there's one overarching, ultimate, supreme lesson that we must learn in our hospice state, it is the extent to which we are connected with all species and every living being in the universe. Animals understand with their bodies and highly intuitive nervous systems the extent of this connection. So the real questions for all of us hospice dwellers are, what do I have to offer? How can I offer it? What gifts do I have that will enhance my ability to serve the other living beings with which I'm inextricably connected? As you think about those questions, we're going to take a station break, and we'll be right back. This is the Lifeboat Hour, and I'm Carolyn Baker. Who was it that said, the problem is you think you have enough time? I'm not remembering exactly who said that. I've seen it attributed to various people. But the real deal is that we all have gifts, skills, and talents of various kinds that the world desperately needs. And if we're not using them, it's time to begin. If you are using them, then good on you. And it isn't about having lots of training and preparation to use your gifts. Those gifts don't have to be formal practices or procedures or occupations. Your gift might involve expressing extra kindness to the checkout person at the store or thanking the customer service person you're dealing with on the phone. It might be volunteering with an animal rescue or a welfare group. It might be striking up a conversation with a homeless person. If there's anything all living beings need right now and right here, it's more kindness. This really is all about love. The Spanish poet Antonio Machado wrote a short but powerful poem which gets to the heart of what I'm saying. It's called The Wind One Brilliant Day. It's a conversation between the wind and a man's soul. And it goes like this. The wind one brilliant day called to my soul with an odor of jasmine. In return for the odor of my jasmine, I'd like all the odor of your roses. I have no roses. All the flowers in my garden are dead. Well then, I'll take the withered petals and the yellow leaves and the waters of the fountain. The wind left, and I wept, and I said to myself, what have you done with the garden that was entrusted to you? You have that garden of gifts within you, And I'd like to play a song now that speaks to how simple our giving and living with full aliveness and passion and generosity can be. I want to thank my friend Paul, not the Paul who wrote the article on climate change and the collapse of civilizations, but another Paul, for sending me the link to this song. It's actually a country music hit, and not being a huge fan of country music, I was a bit reluctant until I listened to it, and then I realized I have to play it tonight. This is Tim McGraw with Live Like You Were Dying.
I was in my early 40s with a lot of life before me when a moment came that stopped me on a dime. I spent most of the next days looking at the x-rays, talking about the options and talking about sweet time. I asked him when it sank in that this might really be the real end. How's it hit you when you get that kind of news? Man, what'd you do? And he said, I went skydiving, I went Rocky Mountain climbing, I went 2.7 seconds on a full moon. And he said, someday I hope you get the chance to live like you were dying. He said, I was finally the husband, but most of the time I wasn't. And I became a friend would like to have. And all of a sudden going fishing wasn't such an imposition. And I went 3 times that year, I lost my dad. Well, I finally read the good book and I took a good long hard look at what I'd do if I could do it all again. I went skydiving, I went Rocky Mountain climbing, I went 2.7 seconds on a bull named Blue Manchu. And I looked deeper and I spoke sweeter and I gave forgiveness I'd been denying. And he said, someday I hope you get the chance to live like die. Like tomorrow was a gift and you got eternity to think about what you do with it. What did you do with it? What did I do with it? What would I do with it? Skydiving, I went Rocky Mountain climbing, I went 2.7 seconds. Like you were dying.
That was Tim McGraw, Live Like You Were Dying. This is the Lifeboat Hour, and I'm Carolyn Baker. One of my favorite contemporary poets is Mark Nepo, spelled N-E-P-O. He's the author of a number of books, including 7,000 Ways to Listen and The Book of Awakenings, plus a poetry book entitled Reduced to Joy. I recently heard an interview with him in which I began taking fast and furious notes, and I want to share some of what he said here because it is so relevant to our lives in a time of extinction. One thing he pointed out is that modern culture suggests that we should and can find heaven on earth. Mark Nepo says, rather than finding heaven on earth, we are asked to release heaven by living on earth. And what are we releasing? Our spirit, our soul, our creativity. He went on to say that one of the biggest misconceptions in our culture is that things like art, music, poetry, and dance are entertainment. They are not entertainment because, in fact, they are as necessary as the air we breathe because they help us stay in relationship with who we are. They reveal our core, which is why expressing them is often so scary. Our core is the sacred, something much greater than the rational mind and the human ego. And we stay in touch with our core by loving and sharing art, music, poetry, and other creative expressions. Or, if we have no interest in our core and don't even consider that we have one, we may be broken open by life. And whatever opens us up, he says, is not as important as what it opens. That's not to minimize the difficulty or pain of what breaks us open, but usually what breaks us open batters or breaks the heart. And perhaps the thing that breaks us open doesn't make any logical sense, but an open heart is more likely than a closed one to find meaning in the breaking. This is what's going on right here, right now. Our species is being broken open. When we are broken open by anything, it's really important not to push it away and deny it, but rather stay in relationship with what is breaking us open. The challenge is to surrender to it. And what does that mean? What does surrender look like? Well, to use an image from another species, and certainly the dolphin know this, we find the current and go with it. As humans, we have the opportunity to align with whatever is breaking us open and let it flow through us by way of love, service, and creative expression. In the end, it's all about aliveness. The purpose of being alive is to be fully alive. Now, that sounds insultingly simple, doesn't it? But most of us don't understand this. The moment we do understand this, we are in the territory of the sacred because full aliveness sacralizes our lives. Mark Nepo speaks of, and these are his words, the unnameable unity that wants us to be as alive as possible. Being as alive as possible, he says, is called living a poetic life. The paradox of near-term extinction is that if we are willing to be taught by it, we become more alive than we could have ever become without it. In a couple minutes, we're going to open the lines for callers, and tonight I really would like to hear from you regarding what you have to offer other living beings. What are you doing to express your gifts? And as I said before, that doesn't have to be flashy and flamboyant and enormous. It can be very simple. And also, what might be stopping you from expressing these gifts? Do you have a question that you would like to ask about this? Do you have a brief story to share about this? If so, give us a call at 888-874-4888, and we'll try very hard to take your call. Meanwhile, as we're waiting for callers, I mentioned earlier that I wanted to return to the subject of the collapse of Mayan civilization. What I want to share is that in February 2015, two friends and I are going to be conducting a tour of sacred sites in Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. The name of the tour is The Indigenous Heart, Reconnecting with the Eternal in a Time of Endings. This all-inclusive tour provides an opportunity to explore ancient Mayan culture, its ruins, its people, and its ancient wisdom as modernity is confronted with a series of crises and transitions. It offers a profound moment of learning from a civilization that survived centuries of adversity and eventual demise. Yet, that civilization still influences a vast area of Central America culturally, spiritually, and ecologically. On this tour, we're going to combine moderately paced sightseeing with space for rest, spiritual renewal, and connection with others. Immersion in a magical and beautiful ecosystem in combination with delicious and lovingly prepared gourmet food, conversations with Mayan elders, and an exploration of ancient ruins offers sacred time and space for restoring the soul and body in deep intimacy with the earth. This will be an opportunity not only to learn and connect with the ecosystem, but it will also be a time of fun and play and connection with other members of the group. So if you'd like to learn more about the tour, please email me at carolyn@carolynbaker.net. So I'm really eagerly waiting for callers with comments or questions about anything that we've been talking about tonight, about offering your gifts. This is an opportunity to have some conversation, to have some dialogue. Because I know that people that listen to this show, I know who some of you are because you comment on Facebook or you send me emails. I know a little bit about some of the things that you're doing in your lives. And I'd like to hear from you, perhaps not just about the gifts that you're offering or maybe what might be standing in the way of the gifts you're offering, but also perhaps ways that you have been broken open or are being broken open as you struggle with, as you confront these issues of what's happening with our ecosystems and catastrophic climate change. Would really love to hear from you. Ask a question, make a comment. Please give us a call at 888-874-4888. And while we're waiting for folks to call in, I would actually like to tell you a little story that comes from Central America that has to do with gifts. Now, many of you know that I like to tell stories with an African drum. Unfortunately, it's pretty hard to do the African drum on the radio, so I don't even have my drum with me tonight. But I would like to just tell this story. So here is this story that comes from Central America. You know, there's no, like, original version of a story, because most of these stories come from ancient civilizations, and original version is kind of an oxymoron, because they're passed down through oral tradition, and they're always changed in certain ways as they're passed down. So the person who tells this story, and I have heard him tell it very powerfully, is my friend Michael Mead, who is a drummer, storyteller, mythologist, has been a great influence on me, a mentor and friend. And this story comes from the Mayan culture, actually. And it's the story of a boy, Poder, P-O-D-E-R. And in Spanish, Poder means power, powerful, or to be able. So the story goes like this, that a woman in a particular village was about to give birth to her first child. And because she knew the birth was coming quickly, she sent a message to the midwife to come as soon as possible and help her. The midwife and other women came to help the mother, and the contractions became stronger and stronger, and the woman gave herself completely to the birth. In the throes and upheaval of the birth, no one noticed the crowning of the baby, nor did they notice that the boy came into the world with certain gifts. According to the myth, the boy entered the world wearing a green cloak and carrying a gourd full of water. The midwife immediately took these and put them away so that no one would see them, and then she went back to help the mother. It was a normal birth, and the mother and baby were in good health afterward. Meanwhile, word went out to the village that the woman had given birth to a boy, and everyone wanted to see him because they knew that each child born is a gift to the village. Several days later, a naming ceremony was held, and people came bringing food and gifts, and at that time, the child was named Poder. Now, we do have a caller. I'd like to finish the story, if I might. Please hang on, Amy from Oregon, because I'm going to finish the story, and it may somehow relate to your question. In those days, children were not perceived as yet another burden for the family or yet another financial obligation, but rather, children were seen as little gift givers. Nevertheless, the people did not yet see the gift poder, and in a few days, the midwife took the green cloak and the gourd the poder brought into the world out beyond the village to a place called the Holy Hills, and she gave those to some people who lived out there. She returned, life went on, and the boy went through all the ups and downs of childhood. He had good days and bad days. He loved and he was abandoned like everyone else. But one day as he entered adolescence, he began to question, and he asked many questions to the people in the village and to his family. For example, he asked, "Do I have something to give to this world, and does this world have something to give me?" No one was able to answer his question, but he had been told that the midwife who helped bring him into the world was a very wise woman. So he went to her and asked, "What do I do with these burning questions?" And rather than saying, "You must go to college," or "You should see a therapist," or "Why don't you join the revolution or the army," she said, "You must go out into the Holy Hills and carry your questions there to the world." So Poder took leave of his family and headed for the Holy Hills with nothing but a bit of food and water given to him by his mother. And after a while, he had no food left, and all he carried with him were questions. While wandering, Poder encountered some people who were doing rituals and who welcomed him warmly. They asked him why he was wandering the Holy Hills, and he told them about the questions he carried and that he longed to know the answers. Did he have something to give the world, and did the world have something to give him? The people listened and answered that both things were true. After they all shared a meal, the people brought his green cloak and gourd that had been his birthright and handed them to him and explained that he had been born with those exact gifts and that it was now time for him to learn the meaning of them. Poder was introduced to a person who had similar gifts, and he learned that those born with a green cloak and a gourd of water were destined to become rainmakers in this part of the world that was so hot and dry. To be able to bring rain was not only important, but could be a life-saving experience for everyone. Poder was a good student and paid close attention to his teachers and the lessons for understanding the use of his gifts. Eventually, he became able to roll up into the clouds and loosen the waters held in the sky. He learned how to handle his gifts and how to protect them, when to use his talents, and how to be ready to participate in life and give gifts to the world. But soon it was time for Poder to return to his village, and he took leave and thanked the people who had received him and given him back his gifts. Back home in his village, he began serving the people there, helping bring rain down to the earth so the people could grow corn and beans and squash. The people recognized that he was using his gifts to benefit the community, and soon he became a favorite son of the village. Now, naturally, there was a youth in the village who had no idea what his gifts were, and he began following Poder around in order to learn where he kept his gifts and to observe how Poder was able to achieve rainmaking. Unfortunately, one day when Poder was busy, the other young man went to where Poder had ridden his green cloak had hidden his green cloak and gourd, and the young man began to imitate the motions of Poder, and, you know, he tried to roll up into the clouds as Poder did. He was able pretty much to do the same thing, and the clouds began to rumble, and rain started to fall from them onto the earth. People were glad to see the rain, but the young man who stole the gifts had no idea how to use them. A small, gentle shower became a downpour that grew into a huge storm. The storm became severe with hail and lightning that damaged the crops in the village's fields, and eventually all the crops were washed away in a flood that threatened to consume the entire village. The people said that God had become angry at the misuse of the young man's powers, and they say that God finally stopped the rain and knocked the false rainmaker back down to the earth. Thereafter, Poder was able to reclaim his gifts. The people eventually restored the village and planted new crops. However, after these terrible events, people say that no one, not even the midwives, have the ability to receive the gifts that children bring into the world when they are born. Because we are descendants of those people, most people do not know what their natural gifts and powers might be. The people of Poder's village and their descendants say that the God-given gifts of most people remain hidden, and few know what they are intended to give this world. Many live their entire lives without knowing. They say that is why so many people imitate what others do and become envious of those who find their gifts. Thus, many people rise to the top without really knowing what their gifts are or how they were intended to use them to serve the world. Thus ends the story of Poder. Amy, what do you have to say to us?
Well, I guess it does touch upon my question, because I know that I have gifts, but I don't know about pressing past the good enough, the not good enough part of me to actually put things down on paper and go through what it takes to submit them and write all the things that I have inside, because that might be one of my gifts, but I still struggle through the entire not good enough thing. And to find a way when time is running out, and time is out, to make a difference still, when I feel broken inside, I don't know how to do that. I just have too many regrets sometimes. And
well,
I'm
you know
trying
what,
to learn
Amy,
how to get past them.
The very fact that time has run out makes your gifts enough. Okay? Because we desperately need them. And, you know, my suggestion is that you focus on how much the gifts are needed, rather than all those tapes in your head that are saying, not good enough, not good enough, not good enough. You know, just to begin by getting it out. And not be, if you can, to back up into a place that we all have called the neutral witness. You know, because all of that stuff about not good enough really is the ego, and it's our woundedness and our brokenness and all the times we've been hurt in our lives. But there's another part of us that can stand back from that as an observer and just kind of watch all of that going by and just write anyway. And we hear the tapes and, oh, yeah, this is my brokenness speaking. Okay, but I'm going to keep writing because we don't have any more time and the world really needs this.
Yeah.
Is that helpful?
And it's hard to do the writing without the emotions becoming overwhelming.
Right, right.
Because it's not just one person I'm grieving. It's the loss of everything that's dying in the world. And
right.
To get past that and find a way to contribute somehow, I guess the part I'm still working on is learning the healing part inside me.
Yeah, yeah.
And trying to find that inside is not always easy. To find those connections. But,
so
yeah,
that is
it
the
does,
next thing. That's the next thing,
yeah,
I was going to ask
help.
You is, you know, to have support for the grieving, to have connections that, you know, support you for the healing that you're working on, because none of us can do that in isolation.
have online connections.
Good. Well, that's better than nothing. If you can get real live human beings that are breathing around you, that's even better.
That's always better, yes. I hope to do that in the future.
Thanks for your call, Amy. We have Hope
Thank
from
you.
Rhode Island.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Hope. What's your question or comment?
I guess it's a comment. I was listening to you, and I haven't heard you before, and I was very much enjoying every part of your show, and I thought, well, there's a gap in that you had called for dialogue, and it hadn't arrived yet. And I thought, well, I actually have all kinds of gifts, and I've had this very rich sort of a life in that I sidestepped the mainstream as a very young adult. And I find, you know, I have so much empathy for the last caller because having the mindset that we're headed toward trouble and having the mindset that, you know, trouble has already arrived and we're done is a paralyzing sometimes. But one gift I have is that I think I'm good at listening to people, and I'm also good at talking to people. I'm good at talking to people I don't know yet. And you're someone I don't know yet. And I thought, well, why not just talk and see what comes of it.
Well, I'm very glad you did. You took a big risk by doing that. And, you know, every time we reach out and talk to somebody else that we don't know, especially, my goodness, online or I mean, on the radio, live radio, that's a big deal. So I really appreciate that you took this risk tonight. And, you know, in addition to the gifts of talking with people and listening, is there anything else that that you have to give or want to give?
I think that I'm not sure what is the best route to take. I'm a good thinker, and I have a lot of skills that fall in the sustainable category, and I have a lot of experience in areas of innovation and parenting and organizing. I really have had a rich life, so I feel that my gifts right now are for my children and my family to just use me, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you said that, because parenting is probably the hardest job in the world, the most challenging, and, you know, we don't know what the future of our children is going to be. We don't know what our own future is going to be. And so putting your energy, your love, your time into your children, for everybody I'm talking to who's a parent, is really, really important. It is a wonderful, wonderful way to pass on your gifts. Absolutely.
And I guess I'll take your advice for the silent observer, the neutral witness, because
I fail
with all my love and good intentions and whatever gifts I have, I fall short. And
we all do.
I guess I just have to pick it up and keep going with it.
Keep doing it. And, you know, that's the thing. In this culture, when we do something out of love or we do something to give our gifts, because of our wounding and our upbringing in this culture, we're going to get all kinds of, you know, stuff in our heads about it's not good enough, it's got, you know, because that's what culture is all about. It's not good enough. You know, I want to suggest working with animals. There is no animal that is going to come up to you and say, excuse me, what you're giving me right now is not good enough. Because, you know, they operate on a little child probably is the same way. They're not going to do that because they don't think in those terms. It's only the enculturation of industrial civilization that causes us to think in those terms. So give as if there's no tomorrow, because there may not be a tomorrow. Thank you so much, Hope, for your call.
Thank you
really
very much.
Really appreciate it. Lisa in Colorado, she wants to piggyback off of Amy's comment. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi, Carolyn. How are you?
Hi. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks. I kind of had a comment about, you know, I kind of want to put my gifts out there as well, but I was really struck by Amy, and this could be one of my gifts, is reframing. But for Amy and for anybody else listening, I think sometimes our greatest gift to the collective is our own healing and not having to have regrets that we might have a gift that we can't get out there, and that loving ourselves and attending to our own healing is probably energetically one of the greatest gifts we can give the world.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, for people, for example, who are parents, the greatest gift that you can give your child is to do your own emotional work. Now, that does not mm-hmm. that does not mean that you're perfect, you've reached sainthood, you're walking on water, and you have no emotional issues. It doesn't mean that you're going to be a perfect parent. But it is giving them a tremendous gift by doing your own work. And that also helps the community. It helps everybody in our lives. So I'm really
right.
glad you're naming that.
Yeah, and I work, I guess one of my gifts is more on the energy level. And so when I listen to callers and things like that, I always think about, you know, we want to see the productive side of our gifts as something that is tangible. And sometimes, like, you know, we were discussing that greatest gift is that inner work, and that healing is, you know, what we can do for ourselves. And it reflects energetically into the collective as well.
Absolutely, it does. Yeah, anything that we do, you know, to go deep within ourselves paradoxically affects the entire world.
Yes, most definitely.
Well, thank you for that. And
sure.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's all I wanted to say tonight, was to kind of be sure that if we have gifts, don't feel like it has to be something that we can see in a productive way, because our culture focuses on productivity.
Yes.
And sometimes the deep-rooted essence healing is probably one of the greatest gifts we could ever give anybody.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I really appreciate your piggybacking on what Amy had to say and what Hope had to say. And I wish you well in your healing. Peter in Colorado. Go ahead, Peter.
I was curious about any comments you might have on the loss of Robin Williams, and someone who had a great deal of gifts to provide all of us and open a lot of ideas and everyone's lives. And just wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, there's a wonderful article that I sent out to the subscribers of my Daily News Digest that... let's see, it was, I'm trying to find it. It's an article that I sent out in which the author stated that depression is not a disease, but rather a need, indicates the need for a change of consciousness. And I posted it on my Facebook page,
okay.
So you might want to go there and take a look at that article. I think it's really good in speaking to, you know, depression is such a common phenomenon in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
This is a depressing culture.
Yeah.
And some of that is, you know, has to do with brain chemistry. And there are situations in which people really do need chemical support and balance in terms of the brain chemistry. And there are other situations in which that's not enough, or that doesn't go far enough. And, you know, we've had Francis Weller on this show a couple of times, and he's talked about that in some cases, or many cases, Depression is unmetabolized grief.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, we just know for sure that any man as funny and gifted as Robin was certainly was carrying a tremendous amount of grief.
Right, right.
And you know, and he had come to a point where it seems like it was just too much to carry anymore.
Right.
And so, you know, I think he's giving us a gift in his passing.
Mm-hmm.
As tragic as it is, there's a gift there.
Right.
And hopefully we can learn from it. But I'd like you to go to my Facebook page and read that article that I posted about a need for a change in consciousness.
Oh, I'll do it. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for calling in, Peter. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Carol. All right. Bye.
Yeah. So let's go back for a minute to the story of Poder, the young man who has his gifts, you know, put aside by a well-meaning midwife, and then he has to go find them. And notice that he has to go on a journey to find them. It's not like, you know, somebody said, okay, now here's your gifts now. He has to go and do things that are risky, go to unfamiliar territory, deal with people he doesn't know. And as he does this, he reclaims these gifts, but invariably in the process, he encounters somebody who's trying to imitate the gifts, who hasn't done the work that he's doing, who hasn't made the journey that he's made, who's trying to give the gifts out of ego rather than from that deeper place that comes from making the journey. So it's a beautiful and powerful story, and you notice that the gifts weren't for him, and they weren't about people looking at him and adoring him. They were about serving the community. And that's a very important piece of the story, and a piece that we've touched on tonight, as people have, and particularly as the first caller mentioned, the whole temptation to be constantly analyzing, are the gifts good enough? Are the gifts good enough? Well, that's an industrial civilization question. And a heart question, a soul question is, just give the gifts. You know, what do I have to give? And go do it. And get as much support as you can from other people, but give the gifts. And be really simple about it. You know, start small and just do it. Just do it. We're out of time, folks. We need to stop here. We're going to be with Laura Carlson. She's going to be with us next week. She works for the Center for International Policy and has been a researcher and activist and author on Latin American and U.S.-Mexican border issues. She's going to talk to us next week about the child migrant crisis, which, as I said earlier, affects all of us in some way. And incidentally, if you have some way of giving your gifts to this situation, you don't have to live near the border, because a lot of these kids are coming to us. And so there are ways that we can serve. There are ways that we can extend our hearts. So thank you all for listening. I really appreciate it. Be back with you again next week with Laura Carlson. Have a wonderful week and give your gifts.
Still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows.